How do you do? Mind coming with us? We want you to meet two people whose paths crossed after thousands of wandering miles. People who desperately needed to become free of every fear. And you'll learn how at last their hearts and minds and lives were unshackled. From Chicago, Crossroads of America, the Pacific Garden Mission presents Unshackled, the unique transcribed dramatic series telling the real-life stories of actual people. For more than 82 years, the Old Lighthouse has offered the open secret of a new life to the men and women of Chicago's Skid Row. Now, through Unshackled, it's reaching straight to you with the same secret of the same new life. Straight to you could mean straight to almost any place in the world, for these days, Unshackled is heard in more places than ever before. And this is because of the determination of many of our listeners to help make it possible for others to hear. Because of these loyal friends, there are more and more new places in which Unshackled is becoming known as the program that makes you face yourself and think. During the years 1932 to 1939, the world saw the slow, uncertain migration of great numbers of people. It was an echo of the great events in the book of Exodus, but only an echo. For the driven, hunted refugees from the persecutions in Germany under Hitler did not move as a great body, but rather singly and in small groups. They moved without a sense of being led and protected by God. There was no pillar of smoke by day or pillar of fire by night. There was only fear. And this was written long ago in the fifth book of the Bible.
And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shalt have none assurance of thy life.
Moritz Alexander?
Ja, ja.
Jew?
Ja, mein Herr.
Charlotte Alexander, your wife?
Ja.
And the child?
Ellen.
Aha. That agrees with the information on the papers. You will please silence the child.
Mama, make Ellen be quiet.
Your destination, I see, is...
Colombia.
Yeah, quite so, Colombia.
We are going to the town of Buga, Colombia, in South America. Uh-huh. We have relatives there.
Very well, your papers are in order. You may go aboard the ship. Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.
And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. The little family that went quietly up the gangplank that night was boarding the last ship to leave the port of Bremerhaven in the year 1938. Moritz Alexander had wanted to take his wife and 2-year-old daughter to Palestine. This was impossible, since he spoke no Hebrew. His alternate choices were China and Colombia. He chose Colombia, and there, among strange people who spoke an unfamiliar language, he faced the problem of supplying the needs of his family.
Lotta, I'm home.
You sound good, Papa.
Of course I sound good. Today I become one of the merchants of the town of Buga.
You don't mean it. You didn't get the grocery store?
No, not the grocery store.
Then what sort of a merchant are you?
You might say I am a merchant with a certain amount of mobility.
Mobility? A merchant with mobility? Why, he's a peddler.
That is probably true. But at least I'm a peddler with a certain amount of front.
This I must see.
You'll see it in the morning, my dear. It's a 3-wheeled cart and a boy to push it.
And what will you be selling with this push cart?
Two of the necessities of life. clothing, and pots and pans.
And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. The man who had fled to South America worked day after day to the point of exhaustion. In time, after three attempts, he succeeded in establishing a small grocery store. And that ended his career as a merchant with mobility. The pushcart was a thing of the past. It was somewhere about this time that the Alexander family found a new friend in the town of Buga.
Buenos dias, senor.
Then do you rather speak German?
Yeah, my Spanish is not good.
Then we'll speak in German.
And what can I do for you?
Oh, nothing. Really making a social call.
Social?
In a way. You see, Herr Alexander, I'm a missionary.
Missionary?
A Christian missionary.
Oh.
I'm a Canadian.
But you speak excellent German.
I know. That's why when I heard about you, I thought I should make your acquaintance. Sometimes it does man good to hear his own language spoken.
That is true, Herr...
Dick. Abraham Dick.
Abraham? A Jewish name?
Also a Christian one. Without Judaism, there would have been no Christianity.
You may be right. I really wouldn't know. I have never been a particularly religious man.
Ah. Well, here in Colombia, of course, they don't call me Abraham. Among these people, my name is Don Abram.
Don Abram.
Oh, I brought you this as a gift.
A book?
A Bible, in German. Of course, if you aren't interested in religious
matters... I'm sorry. If you are enough concerned about me to bring me such a gift, I would be most ungracious to refuse it.
Well, don't just take it and then ignore it.
I won't. I promise. I will read your book, Don Abram.
After that, the Canadian missionary was a frequent caller at the Alexander home. But there was one point on which they never came to agreement.
Don Alejandro, you've read that Bible I brought you a great deal, haven't you?
I have. I never realized till now just how little I knew about the history of my people.
Then I'm glad I brought it. The Old Testament is fascinating. And it casts long shadows ahead, hinting at the things to come.
Who understands such things?
Some can be understood. The coming of the Messiah, for one.
You think so?
Yes. When we read of him in the New Testament.
I suppose you mean... Jesus?
Of course. Doesn't he draw you? Don't you feel an urge to accept him as the Messiah?
And become a Christian?
Yes.
No. Let me make one thing clear, Don Abram. We are very fond of you. We regard you as a good man and a good friend. But we are Jews and we will remain so. That is final.
May I pray for you?
That is something I cannot prevent.
And continue to be your friend.
That is something greatly to be desired. Yes.
In time, Don Abram moved on to another South American country. By that time, Ellen, the eldest girl, was taking lessons in English from another missionary family. Then, just 7 years after leaving Germany, Moritz Alexander died. His wife stuck to the job of managing the little shop, and Ellen, just 9 years old, cared for the younger children. Things didn't go well. And in 1947, the widow and her children came to the United States. Housing was scarce at that time, but a home was found for Ellen in Chicago, in the home of a widow, a Mrs. Rosen.
Ellen?
Yes?
I'm going out, but don't be surprised if a young man comes to the door. I'm half expecting my son to call on us today.
What's his name?
Samuel. He's 18.
Oh, I didn't even know you had a son.
Oh, sure, he goes to college. But if he comes, you tell him to wait. I'll be back just as soon as possible.
And that's the way the two parts of this story were brought together. For this is really the story of two people, of Ellen and of Samuel. But when Sam came to his mother's apartment that day, he hadn't the slightest inkling that the little girl who met him at the door was going to become the most important human being in his life. To him, she was simply a bright, inquisitive little girl and an admiring one.
You mean you've been to the university?
Sure. What about it?
Then you must be awful smart.
Not nearly so smart as I thought I was.
Oh, you're just being modest.
No, I mean it. Yeah, I actually had trouble with my schoolwork.
You?
I was miserable. I've never been so unhappy in all my life.
Oh, why?
Well, because learning isn't enough. Before I went there, I used to dream about it. I dreamed of a wonderful campus world with great intellects all around me. And it just wasn't so. Ever since I was a little boy, I've had the feeling that somehow I could learn all the great wisdom of life. But it wasn't there. I felt like a stranger.
Poor Sam.
You know, come to think of it, all my life I've felt that way. Like a stranger.
Remember the words we used at the beginning. Neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest, but the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart and failing of eyes and sorrow of mind. I think that describes, at least in part, the situation that Sam knew in those days. I'd like to ask him about it. Sam?
Well, that's it, largely. You see, I was a seeker, and I came by it naturally because my father had also been a seeker. And it was he who first set me to looking for something, set me to looking for the truth.
Come here, Samuel.
What, Papa?
My son, you are now 4 years of age, and you are a Jew. It is time you learned the wisdom, the faith, and the prayers of our people. Are you paying attention?
Yes, Father.
Then listen. This will be your first prayer. Shema Israel. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God. The Lord is one.
Shema Israel.
We spoke Yiddish in the home, but our prayers were in Hebrew. My father was engaged in a desperate search for God. He had named me Samuel not merely because it was a conventional name, but because he saw in me an answer to his prayers. Day after day, he drilled me in the teachings of the Talmud. And as I learned, his pride began to swell. I was not yet 5 when he took me to shul to show off my premature learning. As a result, I was enrolled in a class of 6-year-olds when I was only 4. It was a 5-year course of study and much too advanced for so small a child. In time, that became evident to the teacher.
Samuel, are you having trouble understanding this?
Yes.
You needn't feel badly. You're a very small boy, Samuel.
Please, may I try again?
No, no, that won't be necessary.
Please.
No, I think we should let you drop out of school.
No.
Until you grow a little older, that's all. Do you understand?
Yes. I understand. I'm sorry.
Then was when I first knew a sense of failure. It left me with a sense of futility that lingered for years. And I felt it, too, in the life of my father. He tried desperately to fulfill every smallest item of the law. Each night he left us to spend the evening in a prayer service. As his search for God grew more and more desperate, he cast a shadow over all the family. Sometimes even my patient mother rebelled.
Isaac, can't you see what you're doing in this house? To these children, even to me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Then just once, lift your head out of your books and look. This house is like a prison.
Please.
Oh, don't you see? Do you really want to be a fanatic?
For her, that was a strong word. She was usually patient and submissive, and she had great admiration for my father's scholarship. One thing was certain. Nothing that anyone might say could shake my father from his search for God. Doggedly, he kept on with his program of instruction for me. Once, just once, the lesson included the name of Jesus.
You see, Samuel, how the people of Israel were led astray by the false gods of the people around them. When they turned away from the Lord to worship at the altars of the Canaanitish idols, the Lord God found it necessary to punish them. In any age, my son, the admonition is the same. Shun false gods.
We don't have any Balaam now, Papa.
Ah, don't be too sure. There are false gods in any age. Today we see around us the worship of Jesus. This is the worship of a false god.
Oddly enough, even then I had the strange feeling that this Jesus, whom my father described as a false god, met the requirements of the Messiah. I knew my father much too well to suggest such a thing, but when I thought of this Jesus as the Messiah, something like a heavenly joy swept over me, and I felt the certainty of a glory to be had somewhere, somehow. A few years later, a new element entered my thinking. It was in the last 2 or 3 years before the outbreak of World War II. Hitler was ruler in Germany, and the Nazi program of race murder was underway. It was much discussed in our home.
Every day the news is worse. A man was telling me just today that he no longer hears from his own brother in Germany.
In prison, maybe. A concentration camp.
I don't know. Dead, perhaps. Who knows? Who knows anything anymore with that devil of a Hitler in power?
I heard a story today in the market, a joke. A Nazi stormtrooper saw a dog lying dead in the street in front of a Jewish house. So he went in the door to tell the people to pick up the dog and dispose of it. So when they opened the door, he said, "Heil Hitler, the dog is dead." And they were so overjoyed, they asked him in and served him a feast. You don't think it's funny?
No. Why should we make jokes about such a thing as this? Hitler is a dog, yes, a mad dog. But our people are dying by the thousands. I am unable to laugh.
I began to be obsessed by the question, why? Why did sin break out so terribly? Because I was a mystic of sorts, I thought perhaps one must come to know sin before one could deal with it. One must know sin on an intellectual level. And so I began studying psychology in the hope that I might understand the peculiarities of the human mind. Later on, however, I became disillusioned with psychoanalysis when I became disillusioned with my analyst. Next stop, science. As my father had sought truth in prayer, I would seek it in the laboratory. For me, the laws of chemistry would replace the laws of Moses. And during the next few years, without realizing what was happening, I drew more and more into myself. As my father had withdrawn into a world of ritual and prayer, I was withdrawing into one of study, of resentment against the cruelties of men and against frustration. That withdrawal became almost complete when I left the university and went to live alone in a downtown room in Chicago. Down the street, over the door of Pacific Garden Mission, was a great sign. It said, "Christ died for our sins." It took me all the way back to my childhood impression about the Messiah. I wanted to go into that place, but I was afraid, and so I grew lonelier. In those days, the one bright spot was Ellen. Each time I called at my mother's home, I found Ellen there. She was much younger than I, but her enthusiasm over what she seemed to think was my impressive education gave me a warm feeling of importance that I think I really needed, and I kept going back for more of that encouragement. Then, suddenly, the whole business ended. War broke out in Korea. In the army, I went through basic training, and then I was suddenly struck flat by tuberculosis. God at last had me in a corner. I couldn't turn to things intellectual. I had no one to comfort me. I was surrounded by sickness and death. For the first time, I had a face up to reality with empty hands, and the struggle began. It was a struggle to stay alive, and it was a struggle with God. Like Jacob wrestling all night beside the brook, I struggled with God. And one of the places of struggle was in the words of the Psalms. "Return, O Lord, deliver my soul. O save me for thy mercy's sake, for in death there is no remembrance of thee. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks? How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord? Forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall mine enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Lighten mine eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death." How long, God? How long? Convince me, God. Give me faith. Give me something to believe in.
No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be all taught of God. Every man, therefore, that hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which cometh down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world.
I believe, Lord. I believe. I must believe.
That was the breakthrough of faith. Tell me, Sam, what happened then?
Well, for one thing, I was released from the hospital not long after. But I was strictly on my own so far as faith was concerned. When I tried to talk to Ellen about it, I found myself alone.
Really, Sam, I don't see what you're making such a federal case about. You read the Bible and got some new ideas, so what?
So everything. Listen, do you realize that the New Testament is all about Jesus?
So? That's for the Christians to believe.
But it follows the things in the Old Testament. Here's what it adds up to. Jesus is the Messiah.
Oh, please, let's not get so excited. It's not that important.
By this time, I knew I loved Ellen. And I also knew that the faith I'd found was life itself. And I somehow got the notion that I was the only believer in all the world. That I was a sort of a one-man church in a universe of unbelief. Well, that wasn't healthy, of course. But God already was working on the next step. And that involved Ellen. She went to college and began finding friends among the members of the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And the story of how she fought her own battle for faith could well stand by itself. For right now, and from my point of view, the important thing was what happened some 2 years later, when Ellen came to me with an invitation.
Sam, I'm asking you for a date.
Well, imagine that. Okay, it's a deal.
But you've got to go where I say.
Well, sure. Wait a minute. What goes on?
Promise?
You go where?
To a Christian meeting with me.
What?
Don't you think it's about time you were a real Christian?
You're saying that to me? You're crazy. I've believed in Christ for, well, almost 3 years now. And you're the one who told me to stop getting excited, remember?
Of course I remember. I was wrong, and you were right. Now you're wrong, and I'm right.
I don't see why.
Because there's nothing Christian about sitting off by yourself and thinking you're the only Christian in the world.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
I won't wait a minute. Jesus built a church. He didn't build a spiritual telephone booth for one-man occupancy. Oh, come, Sam. This thing's a fellowship. Stop being a lone wolf.
Hold on. What I want to know is this. Where do you get the idea that you know anything about Christianity anyway?
About Christianity? Oh, listen, honey, I don't have to know much about it. The important thing is this. I know Christ himself personally.
I don't get it.
Well, then you better get it right now. If we're both going to have the same faith, we're going to have to follow Jesus. If it's all the same with you, let's follow him together.
It took years, it covered thousands of miles, and it took the gradual breaking down of pride and indifference. But the result was worth it all. The Rosens, Ellen and Sam, are two of the most charming, well-balanced, agreeable people that I know. Sam doesn't have the look or manner of a man who is seeking and never finding. His is the confidence of a man who is home at last, fulfilled. Heir to a great promise, a son of God's own chosen people, he has found peace and joy in Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, the promised one of Israel. The world is full of seekers, and you may be one of them. If so, give yourself a chance to know the one who is the answer to every search. For friendly counsel, get in touch with Pacific Garden Mission, Chicago 5, Illinois. The telephone in Chicago is Wabash 2-1462. Now here's Harry Saulnier, superintendent of Pacific Garden Mission. He wants to make you an offer and to extend an invitation.
That's right. But first, the invitation. More and more groups from churches and Sunday schools are making a special occasion of a visit to Pacific Garden Mission. A typical schedule runs like this. Tour the old lighthouse on Skid Row early Saturday afternoon. Then join the audience at an actual production of Unshackled. After that, attend the meeting of our Fisherman's Club, have supper in the mission dining room, and attend the Saturday evening testimony meeting.
How do they arrange for a visit like that?
Well, by simply writing to us, Pacific Garden Mission, Chicago 5, Illinois.
That's the invitation then. Now, what about the offer?
If folks can't come to visit us, we'll be glad to visit them. Our deputations to outside meetings can include such speakers as George Bensey or Arnold Vandermeulen. The life stories of those men have been high points in the Unshackled series. Often we can send the Converts Chorus as well. Sometimes I can go as the speaker or Jack O'Dell. We can send along either of the two great motion pictures, The Street or Out of the Night. For a meeting that will long be remembered in your community, arrange now for a deputation from the old lighthouse.
Write to Pacific Garden Mission, Chicago 5, Illinois. That's Pacific Garden Mission, Chicago 5, Illinois. Heard in the Rosen story were Russ Reed, Norman Gottschalk, Jack Bivens, Bunny Catcher, and Mary Skoll. Original music, Lucille Becker. Unshackled is produced and transcribed by the Pacific Garden Mission. This is Jack O'Dell. Listen, if your life is empty, it can be filled to overflowing. Now that's true. It can be true of you. Oh, please write and tell us that you hear Unshackled. We like to know about it. We like to know what Unshackled means to you. Because one of the influences in the life of Sam Rosen was the fact that before he became a Christian, he was listening to Unshackled on the radio. Write to us, tell us you listen, tell us the station that brings you the program, address Pacific Garden Mission, Chicago 5, Illinois. And if you need spiritual help now, you may call Pacific Garden Mission in Chicago at Wabash 2-1462.